This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Evan Pushak is known professionally as the Nerd Writer. His videos on YouTube have racked up millions of views, dissecting a wide variety of topics from Shakespeare and Tarkovsky to Martin Luther King.
I am happy to join with you today.
Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech is arguably the most important and most well-known speech of the 20th century. It's 1,667 words and 17 minutes long, absolutely riddled with big, difficult terms.
But as the name he goes by suggests, the Nerd Writer goes very deep on pop culture as well. He'll talk, for example, about the debt that Bruno Mars owes to James Brown.
If you want to understand why, at weddings across America and the world this year, thousands, probably millions of people will be lunging their pinky fingers over their heads, you have to go back to 1967.
Our producer, Gofan Emputubwele, is an avid consumer of video essays, and he talked with Pushak about this new genre of nonfiction, born on the internet. Here's GoFam.
On YouTube, you are the Nerd Writer. How did you end up here, and were you always sort of a very studious learner type?
No, I wasn't. In high school, I definitely wasn't. I was sort of a kind of class clown, and I'm still really goofy. But even back then, I was obsessed with things that I didn't connect to education. I was obsessed with Superman and comic books and things like that. But in college and after college, I became really frustrated with this feeling of not understanding what I believe and think about things. I think at some point in your life, you want to have a sense of who you are. The Nerd Writer and the book are ways of expressing an understanding and working out the things that I believe.
So I want to us to look at one of your video essays together.
Okay.
And actually, it's an essay. You write about the same topic, or you write about the same universe in your book, that universe being Lord of the Rings. And the video essay you have is about Gandalf. Gandalf, for those who don't know, is a magician, the better Dumbledore, among other accolades.
careful with that. You're gonna anger a lot of people.
I'm willing to die on that hill. The video essay is about Gandalf's eyes.
In The Lord of the Rings, Ian McKellen's eyes, in particular, carry a heavy load. Gandalf is the moral center of the story. He's also the one who understands the significance of events in the broadest sweep. This means that Gandalf has to broadcast a whole lot of story information to the audience.
The ring has awoken. It's heard its master's call.
Okay, I have so much to say about this.
Great.
Okay, so we're talking about the difference between the written essay and the video essay. And I don't think I could have done this in a written essay with anywhere near the same justice.
Describe an instance of Gandalf's eyes and his acting in Lord of the Rings that's really meaningful to you. Like, what is it that you feel in your body when you watch that part?
So the one that comes to mind is when he's sitting with Pippin in the upper levels of Minas Tirith at the end of the Battle of Pelennor Fields in the third movie, where it's all this war.
And I'm just going to translate. Gandalf is with another character. They're in a castle. Yes. The movie's over, almost over.
Okay. So he's sitting there with Pippin. A battle's raging outside these doors. And there's this moment of quiet and silence where Pippin is feeling despair about the chances. And he says, I can't believe it's the end. And Gandalf says, no, it's not going to be the end. Death, if death comes, is only another path, a path we all must take. And he describes what's sort of on the other side of this veil of death. And in describing it, what he does is move his eyes just ever so slightly over and up and into the distance, as if he's looking through the veil of death to the far green country that he's describing. And as a viewer, what I'm feeling is that I'm seeing this thing he's describing. When I'm just looking at his face, specifically, I'm just looking at his eyes. And I'm getting that emotion of... Let me try to describe this. So in the book, I describe that I am not religious. I'm a non-believer. I don't believe there's life after death. But when Gandalf is describing these rolling hills and this far green country, this sort of vision of heaven, I sort of feel and believe it, that when you're inside a fantasy world, Ian McKellen, his eyes are bringing me to that place. They are immersing me in a story, showing me something I can't see on screen, and making me believe something that I don't actually really believe in the real world.
In the Gandalf video, it seems like you're trying to convey the same awe that you feel to us as viewers, like in the video essay. Is that right?
Yeah, that's what I want to communicate, the experience I'm having. I'm sort of obsessed with matching content with form. And so from the beginning of The Nerd Writer, I've been trying to figure out what is YouTube good at specifically? Like, what are its strengths and weakness? What sets it apart from TV or books or podcasts or whatever?
Yeah, so what is YouTube good at?
So I think YouTube is attracted to breaking things down. It's a lot of the classic Marshall McLuhan, the medium is the message. He was talking about movies, how movies in the theater, it's a very passive experience because you are sitting there in the dark and these giant images are washing over you. And it's high def and you're just kind of passively engaging with it. Then that compared to that TV, you're sitting in your home, the lights are on, the windows are open, things are happening, you have the remote in your hand. It is a more active, engaged environment.
With Kobe up on him. The whole bag of tricks.
McLuhan said that TV was really good at showing processes, which is why you get something like instant replay in sports. Because we're just as interested in seeing the process of the play as the result of it.
Kobe at the line after being fouled by Pippen and rattling it home.
So when you slow time to examine the catch from multiple angles, it's a way of participating in that image. And TV is a participatory medium. I think YouTube takes that even further and is even more obsessed with processes. And that's a function of the ways we interact with it. So you're sitting at the computer holding your phone, you're scrubbing through the video, you're double tapping to rewind or changing the speed or whatever, showing the process of something is really satisfying. The things I'm trying to describe or understand with my videos are the ways that those pieces of art or those pieces of information or ideas made me feel. Like I felt some kind of awe or some kind of arresting emotion about this. There's a famous Virginia Woolf quote. She was an extraordinary essayist, of course. And she said that an essay should lay us under a spell with its first word, and we should only wake refreshed with its last. And so that idea of putting you under a spell is part of my aim as someone who's making videos.
One of the things that, as I've been reflecting like a bit on video essays, I think one of the things that draws me to them is that it feels like, I think that if you grow up on the internet, so millennials and younger, you are receiving videos all the time. You're receiving videos like constantly, like funny videos, all kinds of videos. And I think that there's something about the video essay and the video essayists that I follow where it feels like, I get sort of meditative reflection. Because I live on the internet, that's the place where I can get like a meditative thought.
Yeah. And I actually think what you're describing is, what do people come to the essay for, period? Mm. Like the written essay.
Go there. Do it. Tell me. So,
the essay is not a treatise. It's not a term paper. It's not something systematically covering everything about a subject. It is an inquiry. It is thought articulated in one case in prose, in this case in audiovisual medium. You don't come to the essay to necessarily become an expert on something. You come to it because you want to see thought articulated. The cool thing about the video essay is that you are seeing these people's thoughts articulated with a whole new toolbox. And the ones who use the specific toolbox of the medium that they're working in are the ones that I am most interested in.
Evan Pushak, who's known on YouTube as the Nerd Writer, his new book is called Escape into Meaning, and he spoke with the Radio Hour's Gofan and Putubwele. This week, in a special digital issue, The New Yorker is exploring the changing contours of family. And there's a conversation with Laura Wasser, a divorce lawyer to the stars. Plus, a comic strip by Liana Fink illustrates some of the parenting advice that she never took. That's all in our special issue this week at newyorker.com/family issue. And there's more to come on the New Yorker Radio Hour, so stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Staff writer Kel Fasano is one of my favorite people in general, but one of my favorite people to talk about music. And he's a man of broad taste, from hip-hop to country and well beyond. Recently, he wrote about the rising country star, Hayley Witters. So, Kay, you've got a few songs for us to listen to today. What's the theme?
The theme of this is country music. You know, one of my goals for the magazine is to get paid to do stuff I would do for free. And one of the things I do for free is listen to country radio. I wrote this piece about Hayley Witters, who's an emerging country singer who this summer is trying to get her first single onto country radio. It's a song called Everything She Ain't. And, you know, so she's got her people at her record label plugging it. And it's a lot of suspense for her. She's been building. She's critically acclaimed. She's a great singer and songwriter. But in country music, you haven't quite made it until the radio stations are playing your song.
What's her story?
She's from Iowa, from a tiny town in Iowa called Shoeyville, and moved to Nashville, convinced she was going to be the next country star. And, you know, 10 years later, she was starting to wonder if it was ever going to happen. Ironically, one of her breakthrough songs was about that. She sang, "I'm 12 years into a 10-year town." And the idea is that, you know, she had already maybe missed her chance, but she made a great album, made another great album. And, you know, now people are paying attention. At least, you know, people like me are paying attention.
So let's hear Everything She Ain't.
She ain't a peach, you ought to be picking. She ain't the cup of tea, you ought to be sipping. She treats you like you're broke, like you need fixing. You ain't getting nothing back for all that you're giving. If you're good with who you kiss and say la vie, but I can show you what you're missing. Yeah, boy, I can be the whiskey in your soda.
Now, speaking as a guy, meaning you, whose first piece for this magazine was a profile of Jay-Z way back when, how does this fit into your musical universe?
Well, you know, my musical universe has expanded over the years. I grew up as a punk rocker. And, you know, I think it was really in the 2000s when I was working at the New York Times as a music critic that I started to listen to a lot of country music and found that I loved especially what sometimes people called new country or commercial country or Nashville country.
The big hat.
Well, sometimes big hat, although at the time it was morphing into a ball cap kind of genre, right? Mm-hmm. These things change. And I love the idea that Nashville was this town full of brilliant musicians all competing to write the perfect song. And the top ones get on the radio and get lodged in your brain. I like the idea that writing a song could be a little bit like solving a crossword puzzle.
And how does this song solve the crossword puzzle?
Well, you know, Everything She Ain't, part of what you're trying to do is you're trying to do something that reflects the culture of country music. That's part of the fun of it, and that's part of the sense of belonging, right? So when she says she can be the shotgun in your Tacoma, she's kind of making a winking allusion to the small town Iowa where she grew up,
right,
but also letting you know that she finds the whole thing kind of fun and funny as well.
And where does Hayley Witters sit in Nashville?
So Hayley Witters is a good example of someone who spent a bunch of years in town trying to figure out who she is, trying to figure out, oh, do I get all glammed up to be a country star in Nashville? And what she found, what seems to have worked for her, is to double down on her roots. You know, she's from this small town in Iowa, and she plays it up in a really kitschy way now. She sometimes wears bloomers that say corn star on the back. And so, you know, she wears prairie dresses, and she's really all about, in a fun way, trying to embrace this idea idea of being, you know, a woman from a small Midwestern town. She's also part of a movement, you know, it's been much remarked upon in the last few years that on country radio, you hear a lot more men than women.
Right.
And there's people working to change this. Nicole Galleon is a successful songwriter in Nashville who started a label, Songs and Daughters, which is the label that signed Haley Witter. So she was part of this effort. One of the people working to change this is Maren Morris, who's a great singer and songwriter in Nashville, and she's had great country success while also having some success outside of country music. She had a huge pop hit a few years ago called The Middle, and she has a new album. Maren Morris has a new album called Humble Quest, which is a really good record. It's a really smart record. And her current single, which is on country radio, is called Circles Around This Town.
I swear I don't know how I trusted a Montero with the AC busted. A couple bad demos on a burn CD would take me all the way to Tennessee. I showed up to the new two deposits. Hadn't heard the sound of a door slam yet. Thank God I was an optimist. I drove circles around this town, trying to ride circles around this town.
That is a really bottom-heavy sound. In other words, more bass than guitars or lap steel, whatever.
Yeah, it's got a beat, and then and then when the chorus hits, you hear that country music sound that maybe is something that you're more expecting to hear. One of the things I like about, I love songs that do two things at once, and one of the things I love about Circles is that if you're not paying attention, it's just a great driving song, right? Mm-hmm. I'm driving circles around this town. If you are paying attention, it's a meta song. It's a song about what it's like to try and write a great song and what it's like to try and succeed in country music. And so in that way, it both fits in and sticks out on country radio.
Obviously, ultimately, the arbiter of what a great song is in the popular commercial sense is the audience. But who are the arbiters in Nashville? Who decides? How does that work?
Oh, it's so complicated. You know, it's a little bit of an art, a little bit of a science, a little bit of a scam. Some combination of those.
So?
Well, you know, there's a whole arm. These record companies have whole departments that are devoted, as has been true for, you know, half a century, to getting songs onto the radio, sometimes in straightforward way, flattery, sometimes probably some other ways as well. And then the radio stations.
Some other ways meaning payola.
Well,
does that still exist?
I don't know about straightforward payola, but certainly if you listen to the radio, they might have something called a flyaway, where there's a contest where you can win the chance to get flown to a concert by this artist and put up in a hotel, and you get to see them $500 spending money. And that contest will be sponsored by the record company behind the artist.
Right.
So, yes, there's marketing campaigns, and certainly in that way, some money is changing hands, and the record company is spending some real money. At the same time, there is this science, or maybe pseudoscience, that the labels still do, where they do research. They survey people. They play them snippets of songs and say, do you like this? Do you like that? And they're really, you know, as they've been doing for decades, they're trying to figure out, if we play this song, are people going to change the dial, or are people going to keep listening? And the fact that country radio still exists as this industry devoted to giving people what they demonstrably want, which is sometimes different from what they say they want.
How do you mean?
Well, sometimes people would say, I would like to hear more of this on the radio. I would like to hear more of that. And then you do the research and you find out, well, apparently not. Apparently this is what you like. Apparently this is what keeps you listening. So it's interesting to me to see that all these stations are trying to give people what they want, and the artists are trying to give people what they want, maybe with a twist or maybe in a slightly different way. One of my favorite examples of this phenomenon right now is a song by Tim McGraw, who's been, you know, he's been around forever. He's been making country music for more than 30 years. He's been around so long that Taylor Swift's first single, almost 15 years ago, was called Tim McGraw and was a song about listening to Tim McGraw. So he's as established as it gets.
He's huge.
And he has a song on radio right now called 7500 OBO.
What does that mean?
It's about the least euphonious title you could imagine. I was going to say, can you guess what this song is about?
I cannot in a million years.
7500 OBO is what you'd put in the want ad if you're selling a truck. 7500 or best offer, OBO.
Got it.
And it's a song about a guy who's got a truck. It still works pretty well, but he wants to sell it because it reminds him of the woman he used to hang out with in that truck.
It's got leather seats, a sunroof, it's sitting on 33s that run smooth. It'll get you from A to B, but not for me. Cause every time I turn that key, I see her shotgun riding down a two-lane road, just driving around with no place to go. Singing along to where the green grass grows, hands out the window floating on the breeze. She's fixing her lips in the drop-down mirror. That pretty little thing made it hard to steer. I'm never gonna get her out of there. There's too many memories. Now there's a for sale sign.
Now, my favorite thing about this song is that it is one of two songs currently on country radio with the exact same plot. Right now on country radio, you can listen to 7500 OBO by Tim McGraw, or you can listen to New Truck by Dylan Scott, which has the same plot. It's about having to sell a truck because it reminds him of the woman he used to be with.
The radio works, it don't show dirt, worth every dime I spend. I was gonna drive it till the wheels fell off. Yeah, that was before she slammed the door, said it's over, then got lost. I need one.
I'd love to know what's going on behind the scenes in Nashville when these songwriters realize that they have this song, they think it's pretty good, and then they come to find out they are one of two people on the charts with the same theme.
This is kind of more orthodox country. You got the pedal steel.
Well, it's funny. It's a good example of how orthodox can mean different things, right? Like the Tim McGraw song has, I believe, a drum machine, which is not traditionally how you would do the rhythm in a country
track. Not even by
now. Well, no, I mean, it's still a fairly new version of country music, but the fact that a song with a drum machine might sound orthodox tells you something about how the definition of country changes over the years and how a great singer like Tim McGraw can not only make a drum machine sound orthodox, he can turn a phrase like 7500 OBO into a memorable chorus.
Thank God you explained this to me right away. Now, final pick, what do we have here?
So, a bunch of years back, I profiled George Strait for the magazine, who's a country institution, has more number one hits than just about anyone. And, you know, he was doing this show in Vegas at the arena there. And before he went on stage, he'd play a medley of contemporary country songs. And at first I thought, oh, that's interesting. He's playing a bunch of new country songs before he gets on stage. And then I realized what he was doing. He was playing a medley of songs that mentioned him. There are
Fantastic.
So many songs that
Fantastic.
Mention George Strait that he could do a mixtape of nothing but George Strait songs in that sense.
That's great.
And this is a new addition to that canon. It's by Scotty McCreery, who's a kind of a lower-profile country hitmaker. He won American Idol about a decade ago, and he's had a bunch of hits since then. And this is maybe my favorite, or one of them. It's called Damn Straight.
Nobody in his right mind would have left her. That was her favorite song. She sang along every time it came on. First time we danced was to Marina Del Rey, and I fell right there and then. I didn't want that song to end. Baby blue was the color of her eyes. I can still see them in my mind. Probably will for the rest of my life. Damn straight, you're killing me, man. You know I've always been your biggest fan. Now I can't.
And part of the fun of this is that if you know George Strait, he's name-checking a lot of his song titles.
Right.
And, you know, he's singing Nobody in His Right Mind Would Have Left Her. That was her favorite song. And so part of the fun is finding these old George Strait song titles. And then his idea is that he can no longer listen to George Strait because he misses his woman. And David, you're the editor of The New Yorker. You know something about literary tropes and techniques. So I think you probably have an idea of where this is going. He can't listen to George Strait anymore because he misses his woman. Does he wish he could get her back?
I think he might.
Damn straight.
Okay, thanks so much. It's great to see you as always.
Thanks, this was fun.
Damn straight, you're killing me, man. You know I've always been your biggest fan. Now I can't even listen, cause I'll get to missing her, then the hurt gets worse.
The New Yorker's Kella Fasani, with songs by Scotty McCreery, Maren Morris, Haley Witters, and Tim McGraw. You can read Kella at newyorker.com. Writing about Haley Witters, along with Morgan Whalen, and many more. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Mputubwele, with help from David Gable, Harrison Keithline, Alex Barish, Victor Guan, and Mengfei Chen.
We had additional help this week from Michael May and James Napoli.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.